Oysters and oyster habitat are one of the most imperiled marine habitat types in the world. We've lost 85% of our oysters around the world.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Urad is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Urad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Jeff DeQuattro. Jeff has been the director of restoration of the Nature Conservancy since 2009. He has managed and co-managed over $100 million in federal grants related to coastal restoration, community resilience, golf course, and other conservation-related projects in the Gulf of Mexico. These projects have protected and restored over 20 miles of shoreline and over 25,000 acres of habitat, with a heavy emphasis on oyster reefs, living shorelines, and land stewardships. Welcome, Jeff, to the Butterfly Effect.
Good morning, Tali. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. So I would love to dive into your journey and the profound work you're doing with the Nature Conservancy in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes, sure. Thank you. I've been at the Nature Conservancy. We call it TNC. That's our acronym.
For sure. Oh, that makes it much easier.
And I've been working, I started on September 9th, 2009, and I started as a project manager to restore an oyster reef in Alabama, the biggest oyster reef at the time. And about 8 months later, the oil spill happened. And oil flowed out of the well for the whole summer. And my project I was working on had to be put on pause because there was oil in the water, and all my contractors that were helping me build the oyster reef got hired by BP and the response efforts. And so during that time, we knew that this was a big deal. The oil spill was going to be a big problem, and that more than likely there would be efforts in the future to do larger restoration projects because of the fines from that oil spill. And so we were right, and we took a lot of time early in 2010 and 2011 to begin planning for that restoration and conservation work. A few years later, the Restore Act was put into law, creating the Restore Council, which it was the newest federal agency at the time. And they were tasked with disbursing nearly $20 billion worth of funding for projects related to the oil spill to restore habitats and species that were most impacted by the oil spill.
That's incredible. It sounds like a pivotal moment, right, for you.
It really was. I knew that I would, I was in my mid-career, and I knew that I would use the oil spill to make my career. And I knew that it's something that I would dedicate myself to, and I have. And we've done that through very, very large oyster restoration projects and many other things. But my other project I manage is called Gulf Core, and it is funded by fines from the oil spill. Mm-hmm. And it's a network of conservation corps that stretch across the whole Gulf of Mexico, Corpus Christi, Texas, all the way to Apalachicola, Florida. And we have 11 crews of young adults, 18 to 30. There's about 8 to 10 people on each crew. And goal is to get local young adults engaged in the restoration and conservation of their land, their water, their communities. You know, we educate, we train, we pay them. And the whole purpose for me, as a personal goal for me, is to create a space where we can inspire a young person to dedicate their lives to working in and protecting the environment. They're getting jobs, mm-hmm. they're getting raises and promotions within those places they're working, and starting to see some real benefit from engaging folks who maybe didn't even know conservation was a thing, much less something they could have a career in.
How are these efforts sustainable beyond the initial project that they're doing with you?
So we're in the long game here. And mm-hmm. what that means is, you know, we're training young people and giving them work experience. We have a professional development part of our program where we teach them how to write a resume and conduct interviews and have basic listening skills and conflict resolution and teamwork skills so that they're prepared for the workforce. We've had over 400 people now enter the environmental workforce. That's the sustainability that I like to focus on, is that we're creating opportunities for young adults, many of who are minorities. Those are folks that are usually most impacted by climate disasters, climate yeah. problems.
Yeah.
And so by getting those people who are most impacted into a spot of decision making and action, that's my sustainability vision for Gulf Corps.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're also highlighting, in a way, the value of community involvement. It's not just a young person, it's the entire community there. Or am I wrong?
No, you're 100% right. So our crews are based in locations across the Gulf. They're based in cities like Corpus Christi, Galveston, Texas, mm-hmm. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, New Orleans, mm-hmm. Gulfport, Biloxi, Mobile, Alabama, Pensacola, Panama City, and Apalachicola. These are all communities, and all of our core members come from those communities. So they're not only part of those communities, but then they turn around and they do projects within those communities, projects to improve resilience and reduce risk to flooding, like maintaining a healthy forest or restoring a healthy watershed, improving the strength of shorelines by planting marsh grass or dune grass along beaches or shorelines, or installing oyster reefs or living shorelines along the shoreline to reduce erosion in those communities, in those places. So they're working, the young people are working directly to improve and protect their own places that they live. And that's very important to us, and it's part of the reason why this idea was hatched.
Would you mind sharing a story where community involvement significantly changed the project's outcome?
We have a lot of really cool stories of individuals who had their eyes really opened by the Gulf Corps program and have gone on to work for many, many agencies at different levels, federal, state, local. We had one gentleman, Eric, who started in our crew in Alabama, where I live, in the Mobile, Alabama area.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric's a young guy, African-American guy. He was sitting at home playing video games, and his dad heard something on the radio about Gulf Corps hiring, come work outside, make money, get experience. And told him he needed to go get a job.
Yeah.
So Eric came to us, and And he was just very excited and interested and eager and worked for a season. And then he can't, a season is 6 to 8 months. And in the early years, it was 6 to 8 months. And then he came back the next year, and he came back as a crew leader. And so his nature is very positive and inspiring. And, you know, he looks out for his teammates, and he likes to make sure everyone is in a good mood and have what they need to get the job done. And to see him in a leader position, because he came back as a crew leader, so he was promoted into a crew leadership position. And just to see the way that he had an impact on his crew and how people followed him and looked up to him. And this kid didn't know anything about conservation when he started, nothing. He didn't know it was even something that you could do. And he left the program and got a job with the city of Daphne, which is a city in the greater Mobile area. And he has been promoted to a leadership position in his public works department. Now he is running crews of people that maintain the city, the beautification of the city, tree maintenance, the planting of the landscaping flowers around city buildings, the right-of-ways along the city. Getting Eric into this type of a position and in this role, he is so inspiring to me. You know, I helped inspire him. Mm-hmm. Now he inspires me.
So your pivotal moment was the oil spill. Do you mind sharing key lessons from leading the oil spill recovery efforts?
The job that I had before I came to Nature Conservancy, I worked at a small environmental consulting and environmental response company. And I happened to be leading teams of people that would go and clean up oil spills for a few years before I started with the Nature Conservancy. So it's not a lot of people in our realm, in our environmental nonprofit NGO world, who have experience managing oil spills or chemical spills or any sort of pollution in terms of a response effort. And so I knew what to do when the oil spill happened. We had installed about 50% of our project, of our oyster reef, when the spill happened. We were only about 15 days into the construction. So one of the first things we did was buy oil boom, which is a floating barrier that you can deploy in the water around something sensitive or important to lessen the chances of oil fouling up your project or whatever.
So it's around the reef, not around the oil spill.
Well, we used it around our reef, yes.
Okay.
But it is also used in that way to contain an oil spill. It was way too big to do that to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Since we basically bought all the boom that was available in South Alabama at the time, we were able to get that deployed really quickly. It took another week or so for miles and miles and miles and miles of other oil boom to make it to Alabama. And that's when our contractors who were installing the oyster reef, they were hired to deploy the rest of the boom and to maintain it. So they stick these curtains, these booms out in the water and anchor them so they don't go anywhere, and then they have to maintain them because anchors move, the winds are high, boats damage them, and so they spent a lot of time just trying to keep the oil boom in place. And it's really hard in that time of year, April, May, June, July. There's a lot of storms that we get during that time. Not hurricanes necessarily, but pop-up thunderstorms, and it's part of our rainy season also. So it was a difficult problem. The ways that most of us could get involved were by doing daily or weekly shoreline assessments. So there was a big effort in Mobile and in other places around the Gulf to assign people stretches of shoreline, train them on what to look for, equip them with the tools that they need to record, like a camera, data sheets, tape measures, GPS, things like that, where folks can take that stuff and walk along the shoreline and they write down their observations, they geotag it with a GPS point, and then they report that to incident command. That was a really great way that the community was engaged here in Mobile.
And do you see that more of like a strategy for recovery effort, mitigation of the ecological damage? Where do you see the community involvement in, and in what aspect?
The community wanted to be engaged so badly. They wanted to be a part of everything. There were barber shops and beauty shops sending hair to the Gulf so that hair could be stuffed in these socks, like pantyhose, thinking that that would clean up the oil. The sentiment was incredible, but it doesn't really work like that.
Okay, then what can the community do?
So putting eyes on the habitats that have been oiled is most important at first, because that gives the shoreline assessment teams that are usually from NOAA or U.S. Fish and Wildlife, some government responsible entity. And if they have data on where areas have been oiled, it makes their job a lot easier. And so they're able to go out there and see the destruction and estimate how many blades of grass have been oiled or how many crabs have died or birds have been oiled. All that information is very important for calculating the fine, the amount of money that the entity causing the oil spill will be responsible for paying. And so The problem is that sometimes it's toxic, and in many cases you had to have a certification, some sort of qualification to be around toxic material. And so it's hard for people to get involved. One thing that we did after the oil spill, years after the oil spill, we started doing some volunteer projects where we invited the community to help us build an oyster reef. First big volunteer project after the spill was in 2012, when we had nearly 400 people come out and deploy thousands of bags of oyster shell into the mud along an area that would protect the shoreline. That's a great way for people to get engaged. There are lots of cleanups that happen. There's coastal cleanups everywhere, in any coastal state at least, and people really get involved in that. That's probably one of our biggest days of volunteerism.
Do you use any innovation, any technology for oyster reef restorations?
My first project that I was hired to do was actually testing different technologies to do oyster reef restoration.
Mm-hmm.
There were three or four different types of technologies out there back then, way back when, almost 15 years ago. And they were, structures either made out of concrete or steel, or just bagging oyster shell in mesh bags. They all have their limitation. Since then, we've completely moved away from using plastic in our restoration practices. And since 2000, 2010, there's now like 20 or 30 or 40 different types of technologies that people have come up with. It spurred a ton of innovation in the work. And so now there are whole companies dedicated to building modular structures that you can connect together to whatever length or height or width that you want. And so the field of oyster restoration itself has just exploded in innovation.
Can I stop you for a second and ask you to be more specific? I'm trying to imagine what you are telling me. And I'm thinking of, okay, there's a company that builds it from rock, creates that huge model, and then just deploy it and put it there. I'm assuming that's not the case, and I'd love for you to explain more.
Yeah, I mean, you're not far off. So when you put something in the water to reduce wave energy, you have to study it. It has to meet certain specifications. Like, I've learned a lot about engineering and coastal engineering since this all started, because every shoreline is different. It has different wave heights that hit the shoreline. Some are really high, some are really low. Usually marsh grass or soft shorelines, they start eroding when the waves that are hitting them are like a foot high. And so the goal there is to reduce the wave energy that hits the shoreline to a manageable height. Less than 1 foot height is really kind of the goal there. And so in order to get that height, you have to calculate the height, width, length of the reef, of the structure that you need to put in the water. And then once you understand like how big of a structure you need to put in the water, that's when you can start thinking about the materials that you could use for that structure. Rock is easy because you can shape rock and put rock in to form any size structure that you want, basically. Width, length, height. So that's typically the easiest. And so far it's proven to be the most enduring. So it lasts the longest, it performs the best, but in some circumstances you don't need a huge structure. You just need something to knock the wave down a little bit. And so that's when you can go to these other technologies, because these other technologies, they typically have a standard width or height for their oyster reef units. One big thing that's very popular is using concrete to build domes, like hollow domes, or like a bell-shaped structure, maybe with a lot of big holes in it, so fish can swim around in there and water can flow through there, and fish can hide in there and oysters can settle on top of it. That's one of the biggest problems with oysters that we have right now, is there's not enough habitat for the oyster larvae to settle on. It's mostly mud and sand.
Okay, let's pause for a second. I want to put everything together for our listeners. So on one hand, you are talking about technology and structure to manage waves, to protect the people. And on the other hand, you discuss preventing oil from getting there. But if it's just a, you know, rocky type structure, it's just there to protect people, right? It doesn't really matter that it's oily or not. Now, I know what I'm saying, and I know this is not the case. I would love for you to explain why.
So oysters and oyster habitat are one of the most imperiled marine habitat types in the world. We've lost 85% of our oysters around the world. Oysters have done a lot of things for humans. You know, it's a great source of vitamin E. Another thing is they exist in estuaries where rivers meet the ocean. That mix of freshwater and saltwater, it creates this very vibrant habitat, and it's where biodiversity just goes through the roof. Where the water meets the land is also a very important transition. So that's where you find most the animals is, and the most diversity in plants is that shoreline and the edges of the land. Since we've lost 85% of our oysters worldwide, many of those oysters used to be along the shoreline. So they used to be what they call intertidal, which means that during low tides, oyster reefs that were along the shoreline were actually exposed out of the water for 12 hours. And so we've lost a lot of that habitat. Because of that and many other factors, including lack of good water clarity and polluted waters, development, we've lost these intertidal oyster reefs and the subtidal ones, the ones that are in deeper water that are never exposed. And so we're doing two things here is by protecting the shoreline oyster reefs, you're bringing back oysters to an intertidal habitat. The hope is that by putting these structures in, they get covered with oysters, and then you don't even know it's there. It just looks like an oyster shell, like an oyster reef. And so the purpose of these things is multifold, threefold, really. It's protecting shorelines and protecting places for humans. Mm-hmm. It's preserving the integrity of that edge, the very biodiverse edge between the water and the land. And then it's also restoring oysters back to an intertidal location where historically they persisted and acted as natural wave buffers to protect the shoreline.
Got it. Can you describe some unique coastal restoration challenges and opportunities in this region or in general?
A lot of times our projects have to go through the same permitting and environmental compliance processes that a bridge does, or a road, or a building. And then since it's a relatively new, you have to prove that it's working. And so you have to monitor it. So permitting and monitoring are some of the biggest challenges that we face. It's also habitats and species like oysters, they're not valued the same way that we can value a road or a road construction in terms of money. It's hard to put a dollar amount on the services, the ecosystem services that an oyster reef provides, right? In a lab setting, one adult oyster can filter up to 50 gallons of water a day. We're starting to understand more the services that these oysters provide actually have a huge value in what they do. Not only do they filter water, but when they start building on top of each other, then they create this complex habitat that fish love. Fish love shrimp, crabs, all the species that we like to eat.
Yeah.
It creates this great habitat for them to grow and to hunt and to feed and to lay eggs, give birth, you know, whatever it is.
I'm assuming this isn't the only project you're working on, and I'm curious on how you are prioritizing projects considering the Gulf's vast ecological significance.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to do, that's for sure. That's always a struggle, is what to do next, what's to prioritize. You know, we know that in the Gulf of Mexico, it's the last remaining stronghold of wild oysters. Even though 85% of oysters have been lost worldwide, we're probably 50 to 60% lost in the Gulf. And so restoring oysters in areas where some oysters still exist is very important. It's hard to put oysters somewhere where there are no oysters. There's a reason that there are no oysters there usually. And so we do a lot of studies and site suitability mapping and modeling to determine what areas are most at risk, what areas have the best opportunity for restoration. And you have to mix all that with where's the money coming from? Because you may have a great opportunity to restore oysters in some bay or estuary, but that bay or estuary does not have some sort of a funding mechanism to fund that work. And so sometimes what we have to do is based on the opportunity. And so each state is very different along the Gulf. There are 5 states along the Gulf. They each manage their own oysters very differently. Mm-hmm. Many times they're managed for food as a resource. So that's starting to change. Now we're starting to see states see oysters more of a in their benefit in terms of the services that they provide, not just oysters, but seagrasses and marshes. Those 3 sort of habitat types are all sort of come together. And what really is important now is to find what we're focusing on. The Nature Conservancy is doing a lot of is looking at whole bays and whole estuaries, looking at all the problems and all the opportunities and all the risks that plague that entire estuary, rather than protecting 1,000 feet of shoreline here and 1,000 feet of shoreline there. Those one-off projects are good, but they don't address like the root causes of the water quality issues that we face.
And what is your vision and long-term goals for Gulf Corps?
The vision for Gulf Corps is to really turn it up a few notches. And we're going to work much closer with communities and communities that are more at risk. And we'll be engaging those communities and hearing from them what their risks are. And then hearing from them on what types of things they want to do to protect themselves. And then bringing science so that they can make their decisions based on data and science. And we'll interpret that in a way that is applicable to the communities. And so it's really—
And then deploy it, obviously.
And then deploy it together with yeah. communities, with Gulf Corps.
Jeff, before I let you go, I would love to hear what inspired you to dedicate your career towards the Gulf and for oyster reef conservations.
I had a butterfly effect moment in my life that made me do what I'm doing today. I was in college and I was in Southern California at a city college, Pasadena City College. And I was studying science. I was very, very science focused, geology, marine biology, botany. And I spent the summer of 2000 working at a sea turtle research station in Baja, Mexico. And this town was Bahia de Los Angeles. And at the time they had maybe 900 people living there. And half of them were children, right? And so it was an ecotourism type town, like one of the first mm-hmm. where the local people would take them fishing. And I got to get to know some of the local fishermen because they would give us scraps for the turtles, to feed the turtles, fish scraps. And so I got to spend a lot of time with them. And the guy who ran the sea turtle research station, Antonio Resendez, who's passed away now, was sort of a de facto mayor of the town. And he was asked to convene a meeting with the town, the seniors, the people, the older men who were the fishermen that have been fishing for 50 years or something, to convene a meeting between them and some bankers. And some bankers were coming to town, and the banker's proposal was to make Bahia de Los Angeles into a cruise ship terminal. You know, they'd have more money and more infrastructure, and it would make their town cleaner and healthier. Well, the fishermen had one question for them, And they said, how are you going to get the ships in here? Because the seafloor was very rocky and fairly shallow, too shallow for cruise ships. And the bankers had to say, well, you know, we dynamite a channel in.
Oh, and that was the
end of the conversation.
Yeah.
Because that would really destroy their livelihoods and put their culture at risk. And so me witnessing that moment really showed me how people have to have a space in when it comes to decisions about their environment. And that inspired me right there to change my focus to environmental studies with a focus in environmental justice and water usage rights. And so I was lucky enough to be at the Nature Conservancy and I have a great boss who lets me put into motion my big ideas. That's how Gulf Corps came about. And that's the whole reason Gulf Corps is what it is today.
That's beautiful. I really appreciate that you share that story, because when we do the same with the tree planting with communities, it's not like we're coming from, we know everything that you need. Here are the trees. This is what you need to do. It's more understanding what the community needs are. And then with that, we then see that for survival rate of trees are much higher because there's vested interest both ways, which I'm assuming with your oyster reefs, you see the same thing. So I appreciate that you bring that.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for letting me share it.
Yeah, of course. And now I will ask you of your favorite tree.
Well, the Jeffrey pine, obviously.
Obviously.
No, but I do love pine trees and ginkgo trees. And the reason is because those were like the first trees that evolved on planet Earth 360 million years ago or something. And so those are what shaped our general ecology. It's what created our pollinators and other plants, and it just, you know, a lot of things evolved on Earth because of those trees. Talk about a butterfly effect. Like the pine tree and the ginkgo tree had a huge butterfly effect.
So those
are my favorite trees. If I had to give a specific favorite tree, I would say the bristlecone pine, which are some of the oldest trees on Earth.
I love that. I love that. And I love that you go to that evolution, just like you did with the oysters and us humans and our brain development. Well, thank you, Jeff, for enlightening us on the oyster reefs and for your work at the Gulf of Mexico. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you everyone for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.